Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it.
What's up, OUXers? Today we have Chase Roberts. Chase is a senior content designer at Chewy, but today I expect we will be digging in to mostly discussing a project that Chase did while working at Wealthfront last year, since Chewy is a relatively new role. Chase has quite a bit of experience in content design in the fintech space. He was actually at Capital One before Wealthfront. And now you have shift gears from fintech to e-commerce. And I'd like to think, Chase, that it feels like anything is easy after finance, but also suspecting you're probably finding tons of hidden complexity within Chewy. Is that right?
Oh yeah, that's 100% right. I don't miss fintech at all, but it's complexities in different areas.
Right. And you mentioned, as we were just kind of like chatting back and forth in email, that you've actually been using OUX a little bit to self onboard at Chewy. Yes. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like and how that's been helping?
Yeah, well, Chewy's a really big company. It kind of reminds me of Capital One in terms of like its size and like
really?
The number of people you get. Yeah, it's $1 billion company.
Like I pictured it as like 10 animal techie nerds sitting there with like just like with piles of dog food all around and cat food.
Yeah, I mean that's basically what it is. But
okay, but $1 billion company.
Yeah, I mean it's huge, and so I actually got into Lucid Chart, and because they didn't have access to FigJam, which made me really sad. So I just got into Lucid Chart, and I was like, okay, I'm just going to start onboarding a little bit because there's tons of different teams which divide by like design. There's product, but then there's like what I call work objects. That's what I would consider like annual plans and like projects and meetings. And there are different teams that connect to those different work objects. And so once I started like organizing that way, I show this to my manager. I'm like, does this make sense? This is how like teams interact with these different work objects. And she's like, you're pretty close actually. And for like 5 days in, like you piece together a lot of information.
Okay. So this is not what I expected your answer to be. So I thought you were going to tell me that you were OUXing like Chewy, like
I did a little bit of that too.
Product
I
categories. Okay, cool. But it's really interesting that you were OUXing the organization just to understand kind of how you fit into this system. Yes. And I love that you showed it to, what was that, your manager?
Yeah, another content designer.
And your manager was like, wow, for after 5 days. Yeah. And, you know, I get that a lot when I'm using OUX as a consultant and I'm trying to ramp up to like some kind of super niche B2B complex business thing. And people are like, wow, you must be really smart. Like, how did you get this so fast? And I'm like, no, I'm actually not that smart. I just have this little secret weapon where I can like break something down. And it seems like, and I really actually am just getting up to speed really, really fast in a domain, or in this case, actually an organization.
Yeah, I learned from Capital One. I mean, Wealthfront's super small, but if anything I learned from Capital One, is that literally there could be a whole team dedicated to like a single page or even a single module. And that blew my mind at Capital One. So I got to Chewy. I was like, I'm not going to focus primarily on the website. I'm going to focus primarily on understanding how the company works and seeing how that relates to the, I guess you could call them customer facing objects.
Yeah. Okay. So let me know. What do you think? What do you think about an entire team organized by a single page? Just if we want to play org designer real quick, like, is that a good thing?
Only if the other teams talk to each other.
Yes, which maybe happens, maybe doesn't happen. But this, I've seen this at so many organizations where you could have an entire team dedicated to like the product detail page or the account. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and teams, to me, this is just like, I mean, I get it. I understand why it happened, not throwing shade, but at the same time, this is how, what happens is your objects are traveling across these pages.
They sure right? are.
They sure are. They are usually not defined to the single page. And then you get these things like shapeshifters and masked objects where like, it's, or even like labeling them differently. Like it's, the object is called one thing on one page because that's one team, and the object is actually called something different on another page. And it was the ladies from What's Wrong with UX, that podcast, who said, they said it in one episode, they were like, the only people that understand your organization fully, or your kind of like your customer journey fully, yes. are your end users. Like, yep. Nobody with, everybody has these like little blinders on. And I yep. think that like, especially like the parts of the page, like if these people are responsible for this module, or these people are responsible for the nav bar, just the nav bar, yep. not any of the stuff yeah. inside of it.
Well, I work at the enterprise level, so I have to get a good sense of things at Chewy from a pretty horizontal level.
Yeah. Yeah. So what did that look like when you were onboarding at Chewy and you were kind of thinking about like what the objects are from a user perspective, like not from the organizational perspective, but like I can think of one product is probably an object. Did you yep. find any other objects?
Oh, tons of them. Chewy actually doesn't call them products. They call them items.
Items. Okay.
Items. I mean, right away, I would definitely count. And I think I asked about this in the Slack group. I was like, so can like account be an object? Totally is an object. Uh-huh. But you can check out as a guest. So account is optional. So that's interesting.
So like maybe like customer, and a customer might have, right. might be an account holder, might not be an account holder.
Right. Pet profile. That's a fun one.
Yeah.
You could have zero to many pet profiles. Mm-hmm. Item is what I would call, I guess you'd call it a parent object or maybe a base object. And there's lots of different sub items underneath that. Like there's like RX items, which are very different than say like a food item. They have
totally different attributes, right?
Yes, totally different attributes, but a lot of commonalities. But they also have connections to like your pet profile can be connected to the RX items that they need to keep the pet nice and healthy. But what I work on right now is from an enterprise perspective is understanding how what they call delivery experience is the order object. Mm-hmm. So orders can go through all sorts of stages and states and can contain packages. And so you could have zero to many packages in one order. And so then you have to have all sorts of messages related at the package level, not just the order level. So that's the one I'm only week two, but I'm teasing it out right now. Like, hey, what's the difference between order and a package? And how do we need to like distinguish between those things and the delivery experience?
It's so true. Yeah. And then like probably reoccurring orders is another thing. Or is that like
auto ship is what I would call like an attribute that you could apply to any item. And so that can be, yes, an attribute, a connection to an item that can show up in an order. It's like, oh, you have this new order, but this is a very specific auto ship order that went out.
Oh my gosh.
It's crazy. Like week two, I'm already like, I don't know. It's been complex, but it's been fun so far.
It sounds like a lot of fun. So let's back up a little bit, Chase.
Sure.
Where did you first hear about object-oriented UX? And what did you think when you first heard about it? Like, what were your first thoughts? What were you excited about? What were you concerned about?
The very first time I heard about object-oriented user experience, actually, when I was out at Capital One, and I remember someone on the CreditWise team was just doing like a presentation on combining object-oriented user experience with jobs to be done as like two like method meldings. And I was just like, it was kind of like they're doing like a kind of like a presentation for like all the designers. And my first thought when I saw this was, I have no idea why I would ever use this because I just didn't understand it. I didn't understand. Like my mental model was just not at a state where I could just get it. But I think it was also like information like overload. It was like two methods coming at me like all at once. And I was like, I don't get it. But it wasn't until I left Capital One and then went to go work at Wealthfront that I remember I started the project at Wealthfront called Stock Collections for their new stock investing platform. And I remember I was so confused. I was like, man, this is getting really complex and I don't know how to deal with all this complexity. And I remember just being kind of really down one night and I was just like, man, I got to find a way to like simplify this complexity. I mean, I honestly, Sophia, I can't tell you what like triggered in my brain that memory back at Capital One, but I was like, wasn't there something about this, about organizing things not by like flows, because flows, you know, aren't linear. And I was like, was it something about object oriented something? And I started Googling it. And I was like, oh yeah, here it is. And I found like one of your first articles about it. I remember scrolling through and suddenly it just like hit me like a bolt of lightning. And I was like, yes, yes, this is like what I need. So that was kind of like the starting point of like, it started several years ago, but I picked it up a couple of years after that.
Oh my gosh. Do you remember who it was at CreditWise?
Crystal Cederson, I believe is her name.
Yes. She's one of my certified strategists. Yep. Love Crystal. Shout out to Crystal. Very cool. So it like planted a little seed.
Yes.
And you were like looking at these two methods coming together and it just seemed really overwhelming. I think a lot of people kind of have that reaction. But I'm glad you ended up coming back to it. And Yeah, that's really cool. So tell me a little bit, as a content designer, how has your workflow changed? Like, what did your workflow look like before you started using object-oriented UX, and how has it evolved with OUX in the mix?
Yeah, I wouldn't say my process has really changed, but my vocabulary has changed.
Oh, interesting.
So, I mean, process is always one of those tricky things because your process is really supposed to adapt to the opportunity and the problem that you're trying to solve. But I think object-oriented user experiences just give me like another layer of like vocabulary to like talk through things. Like, for example, say at Chewy, I literally, right before I got on this call, was like asking another designer, I'm doing like a content audit, basically. So that's a good common content design practice. Like, hey, I need to improve upon this large experience. I should first do like an inventory and like audit that thing, that whole process. But I just need some clarifications on like how those content bits are all connected together. And so I asked the designer, I'm like, hey, is it right that an order can have zero to many packages related to it? And that this like contextual messaging is really at the package level. Like 2 years ago, I would have never have thought. I would just looked at an order page and said, oh yeah, there's a bunch of different content bits on it. And they are like very variable. I wouldn't have known how to like handle it. So honestly, it's just my vocabulary and the granularity of that vocabulary has evolved. And as a content designer, I can't appreciate enough in the whole process.
So it sounds like it's like helping you ask better questions.
I would say so. Ask better questions, you know, because a lot of content design and content strategy practice is really rooted in like websites. It's really and how websites are like very static, right? Like an old school content inventory is just like, go find these URLs, put them into a spreadsheet, find the titles and the descriptions and all these static content elements. But like, a product is variable, it's dynamic, and there's lots of conditions. And so I don't think there's a vocabulary for that in a lot of content books and resources. And so I think that this, I was literally just watching your video today on conditional attributes because it just gave me again a vocabulary to look at things. So better frameworks, better vocabulary in order to ask better questions.
So it sounds like, okay, so not only like asking better questions, which is awesome, but also like you said, the level, like the granularity, it sounds like almost like the level of fidelity that you're able to see like in this like extra dimension. So it's not just a page with a bunch of copy on it and a bunch of messaging on it. You're like thinking about what that messaging is attached to on the page.
Yeah, I would say that's a great way of putting it. Like I said, I feel like a lot of content methods are rooted in a lot of the like static elements of content, but not so much in like the dynamic and conditional aspects of like metadata and how that relates to content.
Oh my gosh. And I have to say, and we're going to get to Wealthfront in just a second.
Sure.
But like, Yeah, well, I'm gonna save it for when we start talking about Wealthfront. But I do have a question about mm-hmm. once you started implementing OOUX, mm-hmm. How do I think how to ask this? Like, how difficult was it to get up and running? So you're in the self-paced masterclass right now. How mm-hmm. far along are you in that? Out of curiosity.
I think I did like 90% of it. Okay. I think I got all the way up into the prototyping aspect and I just kind of stopped because it wasn't relevant.
Right. It's not relevant for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally cool. So how, like, as you were going through it, talk to me about like how you started, like, was it difficult to start mm-hmm. using it or did it kind of like naturally fit in? Like how tough was it to kind of like get up and running with it?
I don't think it was tough to get up and running. I think the hardest part was just trying to like map it to where I was in my process. Uh-huh. Because I think there's this like idealistic, and here's the design process, and you're going to come in the very beginning, and you're going to do discovery, and then you're going to help define the problem, and then you're going to ideate, and then you're going to... It's like, it doesn't happen. Like, that's not how most people come into an organization or come into a project. Like, you are dropped right. in media res into the middle of a story and you're like, wait, where am I? What's going on? And so that's how it was at Wealthfront and pretty much any project where it's just like trying to map on to what is useful in this process to me right now. Mm. And what can I use right now to help me wayfind and get my bearing in this project?
And so what advice do you have specifically also for content designers? Like, what advice would you have to help people? Because I'm sure other people are dealing with this too. Like, how did you navigate that?
Yeah, first and foremost, I don't think anyone should feel the pressure or need to first start off with like, how do I get my team aligned to using this process or this method? Or how do I use this thing wholesale? To me, really the value of object-oriented user experience is a lens of analysis, and that you're going in and just trying to like, how in the world are you going to explain to somebody else if you yourself don't understand like what's going on?
Yeah.
And so that's just what I would say is like, just have some fun with it. If you identify something as an object, but literally no one else in your organization knows that you're doing that, that's okay. Because if you're able to simplify things and explain it to somebody else, and then great, you're just like the genius master that is able to organize these things in a way that's like super simple. And
yes.
I would say slowly, just slowly find a compatriot who's willing to, hey, would you mind if I walk through this method, like how I'm trying to analyze the situation, and start off like really small and then kind of build up from there.
I love that. And that's definitely becoming a theme on the advice that I'm hearing is like, you don't have to come in guns blazing, like we need to become an OOUX organization and turn our entire process upside down. Like, this is a tool for understanding. And I'm kind of in a broken record. If you listen to the podcast a lot, you probably heard me say that you do not need permission to understand. And if this helps you understand, yes. and yes. then you get to be that genius, it's asking the really good questions that is then like kind of like bringing people on in reverse. So you're using it and then like let people get interested and answer their questions about it if they come to you.
Yeah. I'll also sometimes sneak in very common terms that most people get. Like when I say, hey, this thing, this, I don't call it an object, but like this order, everyone knows what an order is. I'm like, hey, would you say it's true that an order has zero to many packages? And you start to sort of like slip in some of the things in there. Mm-hmm. And then before you know it, when you actually get to a meeting where you get to the diagram, people are like, oh yeah, we talked about this, but now I'm seeing it visualized. And I yes. find that really helps.
No, that's a gem right there. Like start verbally talking through, like with the questions that you're asking, or just how you're actually like kind of like, again, like you said, like using that sort of language that feels familiar to folks, but maybe it even feels familiar, but maybe it feels like a little bit like a step up, you know,
yes, of like yes. From familiar into unfamiliar. That's the common way to introduce anything.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I love that. So at Chewy, have you been able to, I mean, I know it's like, it's only been a few weeks, but have you been able to like get any interest there, or what's, or how's that going?
Actually, one of the content designers there has kind of dipped her toes into it a little bit prior to me getting into it. I actually did my case study. This is getting really meta now. I did my Wealthfront case study presentation with Chewy. And so one of the content designers is like, oh yeah, I'm familiar with that method a little bit. I'm really super psyched for that. This is even part of your presentation. That's the only thing I've introduced so far. But like I said, week two.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, you're just trying to figure things out.
I'm just trying to figure things out.
Okay. Okay, very cool. Well, we'll do maybe I'll hit you up in 6 to 8 months and see how it's going. Because I would love to hear how you are OUXing orders and packages and prescriptions and reoccurring orders and all that good stuff. Sure. Okay, so Wealthfront. I signed up, but I didn't get to play with it too much because I'm still like the money is still coming over. But I went through the onboarding, absolutely beautiful, the marketing side. And I do want to say from a content perspective, like even down to the error messaging or like the messaging that, oh, it couldn't connect to Alibank, but they're working on it. And it was just such a beautiful, like the voice and tone was such a good balance between being playful and personable, but also feeling professional, where I like had this trust of, you are taking my money and you are dealing with my money. So it was a good showing of like, you don't have to actually have a voice that's like really stuffy when you're dealing with banking and definitely down to that micro copy. So can you talk a little bit about like, what was your role as a content designer working with like the marketing, copywriting, the UX writing? How did that all play out?
Yeah. So basically when I started at Wealthfront, it's obvious now that they have this new product of stock investing. But when I started, Wealthfront's primary thing and what they're mostly known for now, for those people who don't know what Wealthfront is, it's like a
What is Wealthfront?
Is primarily a robo-advisor, which just means you answer some questions about like your risk like levels of like investing, and then it basically spits out this like portfolio for you based on that risk, and then it auto adjusts it over time for you. That's a really really oversimplification, but that was their bread and butter, is that they have this automated portfolio you can invest in. It's very set it and forget it. It's a very specific type of audience. And, you know, they have like a cash account that you can open as well, but that's more like supplementary. But when I started at Wealthfront, they're like, hey man, we really got to get in on this like audience who really wants to do their own investing and doesn't want to just be this like delegator that has somebody else do it for them. Cause they're like, we're leaving a lot of money on the table. So they're like, we need to do our own stock investing product. So enter myself, where I got in and they were already kind of working on this stock investing product, where essentially they were trying to build out this one new object of thematic stock portfolios. And this is essentially going to be used as like this like grouping mechanism for stocks. And this would be like a shortcut to find stocks. And where I got started, honestly, was just, hey, Chase, what are we going to call this thing? Like, are they like pre-built like portfolios? Are they template portfolios? Like, what do we call it? And when that's like your first like couple weeks of like, we've already made the thing and we just need you to like just name the thing, felt really intimidating. I think at one point I went with we were going to call them like Wealthfront managed portfolios versus like self-managed portfolios. But honestly, after some testing, a lot of people didn't really like these like self-managed portfolios because people were like, man, these are not, they're not really customizable. And I don't think I want to put all my money into this thing that it's not really easy to separate out the stocks inside of this. So long story short, we ended up just redoing the whole like concept. And I think I told you this and my message to you is that it became difficult because it wasn't like about noun foraging. It was about like object design. Like, you have to make a new object. So a lot of my work came in with like, how do we design this new object? And what do we call that object? What attribute should it be? How does it intersect with other objects? And how does that intersect with the existing objects that already are in Wealthfront? And so, long story short, a lot of my process for the whole year was just answering all those questions.
Okay. You created a brand new object.
Yes.
I'm almost skeptical. I mean, I believe you. I believe you. But like, I always say, like, there's no new objects under the sun. We're just like manifesting them in different ways.
Sure.
Is it like what made it, like, what was new about it? Like, my mind is blowing right now. Like, how was it actually a new thing?
Yeah.
What could it do that another portfolio couldn't do, I guess?
Yeah. So when I say it's like a new thing, I don't mean that this thing doesn't exist anywhere in the universe. Mm-hmm. What I mean is that there wasn't something on another website, and nor was it something you'd find in like a customer transcription where someone uttered this noun. And
right.
We said, oh, there it is. That's mm-hmm. the noun.
Yeah.
Let's just break it down. So so you're in the app right now, right? Mm-hmm. You kind of go to the explore space and you can see the stock collection. So the stock collection is that new object.
That's what you call it, is a stock collection.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So I see. So it's not this like new thing under the sun. It's almost, is it kind of like a starter kit? Like, you take the collection and then you decide how much money goes into each one of those, and then you can add additional ones.
Yeah. So this is the crazy part. So normally when you, man, this is where my content design, like word nerdery, like comes out.
Oh, bring it on. You're in the right place.
Right. So when you think about like, what is a portfolio? Portfolio is like the thing that you are going to put money into, right? And it consists of like stocks. So those are like the nested things within that one object. A stock collection is, it is essentially like a thematic grouping of stocks, but it's not like a category. It is a grouping of stocks that is, I actually wrote a whole document of like what makes a good stock collection. It's a thematic grouping of stocks that are useful, unique, but was uncomplicated to build for us. And it's, when we say it's unique, we wanted to make something that literally, it wasn't something that you could just go to, let's say Robinhood or I don't know, name any other platform, and just put in a few like filters and that's what you could pop out. It needed to be a unique grouping of stocks that had some level of like content analysis to it. But you didn't have to invest in the whole thing, but you could if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. So the primary like action of it is add multiple to a portfolio. And it would, when you click on that, all of the stocks become selected and you can unselect any one of those that you want. And then you just tap another button and it adds whichever stocks you want to a portfolio.
Okay. And so it's different than an ETF too, because an ETF is kind of that, but an ETF is managed, right?
Yes. So yes, that is actually one of the biggest problems that we had, is how do you distinguish this from an ETF? Mm-hmm. And I kid you not, in the very first iterations of the collection, someone actually thought that it was an ETF, but by taking away an attribute, people actually perceived it as a totally different object.
What attribute did you take away?
Okay. I think I can say this. Basically, we just took away the performance.
Oh,
yeah.
And so objects have these kind of like a showcase attributes that define them. Like, and performance is a showcase attribute. It's the first time I use that term, but like, it's an attribute that very, very much defines that thing. But just by taking that away, it made it clear that it was a different thing.
Yes. And so ETFs have a lot of things that, basically, yes, an ETF is a thematic combination of like stocks, but for one thing, yes, they are managed, so there's fees involved with those, number one. Number two, they're also not super transparent. Like, you gotta have to dig into an ETF to like see what's inside an ETF, and there's usually like 100 things in there. And so what happens, Sophia, if you look at ETF and you go, you know, I like this idea, not really a big fan of this one company that's inside of it. I have some moral qualms with maybe a couple of these companies. Do I have to go and invest in all these companies separately? Also, inside ETF, all of the ratios of what goes into each of those companies is also predetermined.
Right.
So what we determined is that people don't always like that. It's almost like giving people just the right amount of like clarity and control over these things. And so what happens is it's quite different in that instead of you have everything preset and you put money into it, if you actually walk through the flow, let's say there's like 10 stocks in a collection and you're like, yeah, I like these, but I have some moral qualms with one of these. You can uncheck it, add into a portfolio. And then when you put money into it, then you can actually divvy up your, you set a percentage split. You say, I want to put $500 into this. Cool. How do you want to split that $500? That's the way I wrote that content. So it's very nice and conversational. And so this collection, I chose the word collection because people are just like, I know this is going to sound really bad, but people are just like sometimes throwing around different terms. Like, what do we call this thing? And so what I tried to do was I tried to like listen out for what is the connotation that this thing is trying to put forward? And honestly, which of these words is just like the right word for the job? And so someone said the word collection and I just started kind of like kicking that around as opposed to like a Robin Hood like list, which is literally just, oh, a list. What does that tell you? It's a list of things. A collection actually hits all the right connotations, which was one, it needs to tell you that it's thematic. Well, collections are by their very nature thematic. But two, we don't want people to think that these things are inseparable. And so if I said, I got a collection of baseball cards, if I said, hey, can I get everything in that collection except some of these cards? Someone go, well, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Right. So it hit those criteria. And so the collection was born. And so then I just kind of went with that.
And collection also connotes curation.
Yes. Right? Yes. Curation. That's another big part of it is that we want to make sure that it sounded curated and also looked curated. And so a lot of content work had to be done. So that's also a different reason why it's way different than, let's say, a category page where the, like I said, it has to be unique. So all those content tiles, all those content descriptions, I either curated those from people and rewrote them or just wrote some of them from scratch. And so all that was completely custom and stored in some rather large spreadsheets. And then it eventually evolved into people liked the tiles and descriptions, but thought that it needed more like why information. And so the collection of having more, what we call perspectives on the collection, that's a whole different rabbit hole if you want to go down what that is and why that's important.
Maybe. But like what I think another interesting thing about calling it a stock collection, is that what it's labeled at? It's called stock collection. Correct. Is you're actually using another word, stock.
Yes.
That is like a good anchor word. Like everybody knows what that is. You know, you understand what a stock is and using that word to leverage this new thing. So you're actually talking about the relationship between the things.
Yes.
On the thing, which I think that that's like a really nice way to say like, okay, we've got this more abstract new differentiating thing, the stock collection, but we're going to use the word of the thing inside of it to really help people get a picture. Okay. I can actually, a collection of stocks. I can picture that.
Yeah. They don't have any ETFs in them. We were kind of like kicking around, like, can the collection ever have an ETF? So it's a group of things. And we're like, no, I mean, if we're trying to invest in stock investing, like, can you invest in an ETF on Wealthfront individually? Yes. We find those into a collection. Not so much right now.
That's really interesting. So that like you actually stepped back from that because it was like, I mean, was it anything? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but like having that OUX perspective, you can kind of like start seeing where you're overcomplicating things.
Yes.
And where like, okay, this thing that maybe like a PM thought it might not have been so complicated, like, oh, ETF should go in there. And because of the way you're thinking, you could say something like, well, that is literally a group within a group. Now we can't really call it a stock collection anymore because it's got ETFs inside. So then is it a stock/ETF collection?
That's not how it went. Where it really went was more like, hey, we want to have this like thematic grouping of investments. Mm. And I more opened up the question of will this thing hold ETFs? Like, is that a thing as a business that we like want to angle towards? Because if yes, then we need to pare down what we call this thing. But if it's just going to be just stocks, then you can just call it stock collections and make it more precise. So,
and getting clear on those relationships between the things is going to help you name the thing.
Yes, exactly.
So, it's almost like figuring out the relationships when you have this new thing of like, okay, what is the relationship between an ETF and a stock collection or whatever, like this fuzzy thing that we don't know what it's called yet, and figuring out that, oh, nope, there is actually no relationship can help you then define that thing. And
and that relation becomes very, very clear, like in the explore page. I have to give props to my product designer, Jared. He is just wonderful. He came up with the UI that I think became sort of like the hero of the hero section. And that is basically, it says stock collections with, and it has the like stock instance. And there's like a little selector for an individual stock, and it shows you all collections that are related to that stock instance.
I love it. The relationship goes both ways. So not only do you see a collection with all the stocks inside, you can see an individual stock and you can see all the collections it's included in.
Correct.
And you can find that. You get a gold star. And wait, and Jared gets a gold star too.
He gets a gold star. Okay, he at one point just had as a way to describe the mechanism, like choose a stock and we'll show you relay collections. Like, no. I'm like, simplified further, just make it where it's just a sentence, just say stock collections with, and as they roll over, the name changes as you pick the stock collection. And here's the great thing, Sophia, the same relationships show up in the search. So if you search for, let's say, Apple, all those collections also show up in the search bar as well in the search results.
Oh my gosh, do you have any idea how this is testing with users? Do people like it?
Yeah, I remember that they did a lot of usability testing, and I think that the only thing that became a little difficult is that because it's not, if you're not holding it with your phone, so people weren't really sure that certain things were like scrollable.
Okay.
That was basically the biggest issue. But like once people like got the mechanism, people said like, oh, this feels really fun. Like, it feels like fun to invest in, like explore around. So the exploration mechanism was fun, but it needed more, I guess you could say, more of the investment case in the collections. And that's where we got into perspectives on the collection. And that was a whole nother set of content attributes I had to build on.
Is a perspective an object?
No. So a perspective, perspective is a subset of core content on the collection.
Okay. So, but I wonder though, is it a local object? Because does a perspective, can you have do you have multiple perspectives within a collection?
So the way that we had to think about it, so here's the tricky part, is that basically all the perspective is it just gives you additional information of what's the opportunity of the collection. And then there's another perspective called the trade-off, which is, of course, what are the trade-offs in investing in this? This became one of the trickiest content things to figure out because we couldn't give investment advice. You can't say you should invest in this. Like, you can't do that. And so I try to think of like, what's the right like label for this thing? And so I chose perspectives because all of the content there is leveraged from third-party sources. So we just had to find a bunch of different perspectives of people who said, hey, this is a good idea to invest in this type of idea. And
self-driving cars or something like that was one of your collections, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or Apple suppliers was the most popular one, I think. Mm-hmm. And so there's like, oh, here's the opportunity of this. Like, well, Apple is like really well known. And so if you invest into all of its suppliers, you know, they all raise together. Of course, the trade-off is if something bad happens to Apple, then they all also get a big hit in that process as well. And so that ended up being, honestly, that additional content from testing, people are like, this seems to be the most valuable part of this is that I don't have to do the research around this topic.
That's like that you're building out this stock collection object and you're adding so much value, not only like, okay, what are the calls to action? What can you actually do to it? How do you easily add it to your portfolio, or and not, you know, deselecting individual stocks, all that stuff we just talked about, and then figuring out what are those attributes and having these really unique content attributes to build out this thing. I have been writing in my little notebook, I've been writing about this idea that Orca is Orca, the objects, the relationships, the calls to action, the attributes, for those out there that don't know. Orca is potentially the differentiating factor between competitors. Like, you can definitely compete on how slick your UI is, how performative you are, how accessible you are. Like, yes, yes, yes. How good your voice and tone is. All of that for sure. But the real, like, hard to compete with thing is, what are your objects? How do they relate to each other? What can people do to those objects? And what attributes do you have?
Right.
Was all that the, a...
Yeah, honestly, yeah, it became sort of like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts type of thing, where it's like, it's not just these individual objects, but honestly, the magic is in those relationships. If I had to put a pin on it, is that the relationships and those attributes, the more things tie together in a way that helps fulfill people's like needs that you uncover in research, the more you have a competitive advantage. Because, I mean, there's all sorts of like, there's all sorts of ways you could dig in deeper into like a stock investing platform of just like adding more and more attributes, right? Uh-huh. You could just add, and there are, if you go into an investing platform, you can find like a stock with a million, go to like Yahoo Finance, a million attributes. Uh-huh. But if those attributes, and my, I say Yahoo because Jared, my product design partner, used to work at Yahoo Finance, and he showed me like the page. I'm like, this is ginormous. He's like, we're never going to be able to compete on this, like adding more attributes to a stock. Mm-hmm. But by finding different objects we can make and making smart connections between these things in a way that's not overwhelming and provides progressive disclosure, the something more interesting and harder to mimic is what you're going to have.
Yes. Yeah. And if two companies have the exact same Orca, the exact same Orca, it's going to be a hard competition there, right? Yes. And like, how does a user determine which one to go to? It's like, oh, like I like this brand design better, or maybe like the pricing or something like that. But those things, if one company starts getting ahead on that, it's really easy to kind of emulate that. Like, oh, okay, this one, let's just, you know, change our pricing model. Or, but if those two Orcas are exactly the same, it's going to be this tooth and nail fight versus like, hey, we've created a new thing completely here and connected it in a new way.
Yes.
And we can now like differentiate through the Orca.
Yes. The tricky part is when you try to Orca after your, I think I mentioned this before, but like object design, also when you're making new things and you have to retroactively add things into a product that already exists, creates all sorts of complexities. So not only is the process good for building something, it's great for retroactively adding into other things and seeing how other things need to be updated. Like, for example, I think I told you a great example. I had a great pet store analogy that I used with someone at my, I ironically used pet store analogy while at Wealthfront. I tried to use the
fulfilling prophecy.
I know, right? Speaking out in the universe. But like the analogy I used was, you know, imagine you own a pet store and all you do is sell cats and dogs, right? And you have like these really in-depth like attributes on these different pets. And then you say, man, we need to get more reptiles up in here, more bird creatures, more fish. Well, now it's more likely that you're going to have, I'm not saying you actually have this, but more likely you're going to have a category called like furry creatures, because that category wouldn't make any sense when that's all you have are furry creatures.
Right. Yeah.
So now you have more high level types of things that you can subdivide by. Mm-hmm. And so this actually ended up becoming a thing at Wealthfront, where there were like these other subcategories of like ETFs that a content designer had like made. And so as we were adding in this new stock investing platform, we're also adding in new ETFs in there, and some of those new ETFs didn't fit in to those old category schemes. So now it's like, oh, okay. Now we have to rethink all these different attributes and the meta attributes of those attributes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so what was the solution?
Yeah. So the solution that we came up with was this. So all these ETFs and they're these like specialty, like browsable subcategories that were made were primarily made for people who were using the automated robo-advisor portfolios, basically. So basically we said, okay, we're making a new stock investing platform. And yes, you can get into ETFs, but if we're really trying to emphasize, like, if our differentiating factor is really these like stock collections connected to these stocks, do we really want to try and create this like super in-depth like categorization system that tries to subdivide all the types of ETFs and all the different types of stocks and try and make this like super comprehensive filtering process? If the answer to that was definitely not, just became a matter of like, what is going to be our differentiating factor and where do we want to play? And so the solution was, you know what, we're going to have this like filtered down search space within just the automated portfolios, where if you want to like go and edit your automated portfolio, you can. So you can hit like this like edit button. It goes to this like sub search space where you can still find those categories. So you don't get rid of them. They're still there.
Okay.
But you can only find them there. And so you have this sub search space for this one group of people. And this prevents people from this like top level search space from getting distracted by all these categories that they probably don't care about in the first place. So we just made a trade-off. It's basically what it came down to is like prioritize for these delegators and this Wealthfront automated portfolio space. And then for these more hands-on people, keep it focused on the stocks and the collections and that categorization scheme. So it's like categorization schemes in different spaces, if you want to use that information architecture term.
How many collections do you have? How many stock collections are there? Well, how many instances?
I don't know how many.
Triple digit?
No, definitely not triple digit. I think when I left, it was probably in the 50 plus.
Okay.
But yeah, we built up systems where it's easy to, like, if you want to make some new ones, you have all the processes in place to figure out how to do that. So I created like voice and tone guides and some pretty in-depth like content prompts. So if people are like struggling to like write a description, I would say like, well, if this collection contains this type of like idea archetype, then you should think about how to front load the description this way. And here's a visual way to do that. So yeah, we just create a bunch of processes in place so people can keep building on those collections over time and then storing them in these pretty big spreadsheets.
Is there a way for the users right now to sort or filter the collections?
There's not. Okay, so this is the one problem that I really had was like, how do we do that? Should we do that? Because there's actually no collection level metadata.
That's my question.
There's no collection level metadata. So this is kind of like a trade-off I had to think about. And if you like look, there are actually rows of different collections, and so these kind of are like the collection like archetypes. So there's like some unseen metadata, like when the I guess you could say when it was like updated and added, that's like a newly added collection. So I'd say that is a form of metadata that is on that collection. But no, you can't filter or sort collections. If I was still there, I definitely think that that's something that you could probably double down on, is like what's another way for people to find by collections. But honestly, we tried to, one of the things we tried to do is that we wanted all the collection names to be pretty, not too clever, but pretty common. So you can actually find them in the search. So if you're like, I have like an investment idea and I think it would be related to like electric vehicles, you type in electric and then of course company names that have electric are in there, but you also have collections. I actually use your method of like getting a page and squeezing that down to a car, but then squeezing that down to a list item. And so I actually did that with my product design partner. So if you search for a certain type of collection by name, you can see that list level item there.
Beautiful. Yeah. So, but probably if collections continue to grow and started getting into the triple digits,
I would say,
then you would need to start thinking about some sort of sorting or filtering.
Yeah, another level of metadata around, like, well, what about these things? Do people? I think that they could probably also get to like a tagging system, perhaps. So more maybe hashtag related is like one way you could do it. Or what if someone else could make their own collections? Maybe that's a thing that people could do. And people could create their own tagging system around collections. Who knows? There's all sorts of different ways you could do it, but right now that doesn't exist.
That's awesome. Well, thanks so much for sharing all of this. I have one other quick question for you. I know we're at time. Do you have a hard stop or can I take like 3 minutes?
Yeah, keep on going.
Okay. So, first I want to ask, just curious, do you have any questions for me? here?
I feel like I always have so many questions. Gosh, I think my biggest question is always, how do you imagine object-oriented user experience like fitting in with like other design methodologies? Like I always try, my brain is always like, man, how can I fit this into like a service design map, like blueprint? And how can I like line some of these things up? Because like we said before, starting with like what's familiar and sometimes familiar to designers and like using that as a transition point to this method, I think would be really helpful. Like in the book UX Magic, it's like, oh, what if we start with like user stories and like broke those down? But that doesn't always happen.
right. And yeah, shout out to Daniel Rosenberg of UX Magic. There's so much good OUXE stuff in that first, I think the first chapter, the second chapter, UX grammar. Yes. Awesome stuff there. And I've got a presentation from him on YouTube. He was the very first presenter at OUX Happy Hour.
I listened to that once. Very good.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you the same question.
I have one that's percolating in my head.
I want to hear your answer because honestly, I'm not the best person to answer this, right? Because I'm the OU, I just see everything the lens of OUX. So it's going to be the service designers. It's going to be the content designers. It's going to be the UX writers and the information architects that are really like boots on the ground figuring out how this fits in.
Yeah, I think where my brain is currently at is, I started reading Continuous Discovery Habits and thinking about how when you're trying to find different opportunities in the space to design something, the author recommends like, hey, you should create like an experience map. And so one thing that's usually in common in experience maps are stages. And so that I started connecting that to, well, there are stages and attributes in object-oriented user experience. So what if we start connecting the dots of like, oh, well, if there's a stage, there's probably some sort of object that goes on at that stage. So if we like worked out from these like stages of like where the objects evolve over time in those stages and use that as like the visualizing mechanism of showing object like through time that way. Yeah. So that's where my brain's kind of going right now, but still working through it.
I mean, so you mentioned a service blueprint. That's very interesting. You mentioned a service blueprint and I have definitely, if there is a service blueprint that has been created or some sort of, or a, you know, a journey map or something like that or anything, high level user stories, all that goes into noun forging.
Yes.
So that's like kind of my like cop out answer is like, if there is existing stuff, look for the nouns. And of course, when you're noun foraging, you're not just noun foraging. You're looking for the verbs. You're looking for the adjectives, and, you know, to figure out what metadata might be in there too. So like using all of that stuff to extract the grammar of how people are talking about this problem, whether it's the stakeholders or the end users or the UX researchers, like how are people talking about this problem and use that to kind of back into what your objects are. And then you can kind of validate them back. So having it as like, again, another cop-out answer, but like it's an iterative process, right? So you might start with user stories do some noun foraging from them. If you've got, if some BA or PM or like a bunch of user stories, you can noun forage from those. Then through the process, actually potentially write better user stories by making sure that they're really connected to objects alongside those folks. So you can kind of like iterate back around to them.
Right.
But I just like, I'm a broken record. This, and we talked about this at the top of the hour, like this is something that doesn't negate anything that people are already doing, right? Like this is just something that plugs in. Like you said, it's a new lens, it's a new language, it's a new way to dig in deeper, but it's not something that like says, oh wait, you don't need to do that anymore. Like right. This is going to replace it. You can just stop doing that thing. That thing that you've been doing for 10 years is wrong. No.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So thank you so much, Chase. That was really awesome. I think we nerded out hard on this one. But yeah. it was great getting into these details. And yeah, let's stay in touch. I can't wait to hear what happens with OUX at Chewy.
Yeah, hopefully in 6 months to a year, I'll have something different to nerd out about.
Oh, yeah. Bring me a good juicy case study, please.
Will do.
2023 goals. All right.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!